The Great Plays series of the National Broadcasting Company presents Curtain Calls for the Queen, a fantasy on the drama in England during the reign of Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Your enjoyment of the Great Plays series can be greatly enhanced by your obtaining a copy of The Listener's Aid, published through the cooperation of the University Press of Columbia University in New York. Listen at the end of the program to learn how you may obtain a copy of the Great Plays Drama Guide, containing complete information about this series.
The Lost Chord by Sir Arthur Sullivan. Oh, such beautiful, such tender sentiment.
One key to the drama of the Victorian era, sentiment. So in our fantasy, we are to present scenes from such masterpieces of sentimental comedy, drama, and tragedy as The Lady of Lyons by Bulwer Lytton, London Assurance by Dion Boucicault, Cast by T.W. Robertson, The Bells by Leopold Lewis, Pygmalion and Galatea by W.S. Gilbert, and Michael and His Lost Angel by Henry Arthur Jones. Also, we are to have a dramatic reminiscence of the tiny, frail woman beloved by millions as the Widow of Windsor. Ah, but the Victorian era is gone. At this moment, it is night in England, a night stabbed many times by brilliant blades as searchlights hunt for an enemy with death beneath its wings. And this scene might well be taking place at this moment, backstage at a theater in London. Shall we say that the theater is the famous old Drury Lane? Shall we say that the first two voices we hear belong to Alfie and Bill, two Cockney porters who have just finished cleaning the theater and are closing it for the night?
What a blooming noise them buses makes outside, hey, Alfie?
I'm glad they do. Working here at night, cleaning up the theater after the performance, why, I feel right lonesome-like without them.
Not likely that'll happen any time soon, with the bloody skies are regular crawling with enemy planes every night.
Not half likely. And with the blackout on, the buses has to do a terrific lot of honking and tooting to get a clear road. Well, I'm all finished, Bill. Ready to go?
All ready, Alfie.
A new show open tonight. Wonder what it is. Did you notice the posters outside?
Me? No. The theatre ain't what it used to be, Alfie. I'm past 70 now, and it must be 40 years since I seen a show.
Ah, now, Bill. Happens I know you've seen some of the shows right here in Drury Lane.
No more than I had to, Alfie. No more than I had to. And that from the wings where I was working. 40 years ago, I gave up the theatre. Quit it in regular disgust, I did.
Yeah. Well, me and the missus takes in a movie now and again. That Eddie Lamar, Bill, makes me realise I ain't the man I was.
Yes. And the theatre ain't what it was, neither.
Yeah, right. I remember. Ellen Terry. Lily Langtry.
Sure. But women ain't actors, Alfie. There was only one actor for me. Oh, blimey. I can remember the time he played right here in Old Drury Lane. Remember, Alfie?
What? Squire Bancroft? Or would you be meaning Sir Herbert Beerbone Tree?
Oh, neither of the likes of them. I mean the governor. Old H.I., the greatest that ever lived or ever will. Sir Henry Irving. God blimey.
Sir Henry? Now, I've worked here at Drury Lane as long as you have. I ain't remembering Sir Henry ever setting foot on this stage.
And I say he did.
And I say he didn't. And what's more, I see you're just trying to get me into a bloody argument, Bill.
I ain't starting nothing, but it would be the first night it ever passed without if we didn't have one.
Well, I'm going home. The missus has got fish and chips, and the bloody air raid warning will start soon and we'll have to duck into a cellar. But I still say he never played here.
And I say he did. Let's get going, Alfie. I said he played in this very theatre himself. Sir Henry Irving.
And you are right, Bill, old boy. I did play in this very theatre. The theatre that is England. though I think of the Lyceum as more my own. Ah, the days of Henry Irving and the Lyceum. The days when Henry Irving was England.
I beg your pardon, what was that name, the name you said was England?
Why, whose name but my own?
And you, were England.
I was the theatre in England, yes. But look here, who are you?
A shade, a spirit, as yourself. You may call me the spirit of woman. What is your name?
Bless me, my name. You don't know who I am?
I didn't catch the name.
Irving. Sir Henry Irving.
And you were saying, Mr. Irving?
Sir Henry Irving, if you please, and I insist on it whether it please you or not, spirit of woman.
Aye, so touchy about it.
I am, madam, and for good reason.
And that reason?
That reason was the one of which I was speaking when you so rudely interrupted.
Yes?
That reason being that during my time as a mortal on earth, I came to stand for the English theatre. I was the first actor ever to be knighted. And thereby I raised all actors a measure in respectability. There. Now can you see why I am jealous of an honour handed down at the order of Victoria herself?
Of Victoria?
And may God rest her. A great woman. You lived in her time, perhaps, madam.
What? I? Oh, ah, yes. Yes, I lived in her time. Our spans as mortals practically coincided.
She was older than I. I was born the year of her coronation, 38, that was. Yet I didn't outlive her by so much.
You played before the Queen, Sir Henry?
Unfortunately, no. Other members of the royal family, yes. You see, she loved the theatre, and she went often the first 3 years after her marriage to Prince Albert. Some said she was even too gay and flippant.
Indeed.
Of course, she settled down quickly, and Prince Albert saw to that.
I think I remember, I must have heard it somewhere, that Queen Victoria saw Bulwer Lytton's play, The Lady of Lyons.
The most popular romance in the entire 19th century. Oh, a great play. Are you familiar with it, spirit of woman?
Vaguely, only vaguely. When I saw it in my time on earth. Oh, so much happened afterwards, so many years passed.
Then let me recall it to you.
Oh, please do, Sir Henry. Irving, is it?
Sir Henry Irving, madam, without mock modesty, the greatest actor of his day.
Oh, yes, of course.
But the play, The Lady of Lyons. Melnot, a gardener's son, falls in love with Pauline, the wealthy lion's beauty. Pauline spurns his love, insults him because he is a peasant. Inspired by Poussin, one of Pauline's rich suitors, Melnot poses as a prince and thus marries Pauline. Ah, but he finds that love overmasters his desire for revenge, and he tells Pauline all. He then tells Pauline to divorce him, and he goes away to join the army of the young French Republic, not realizing that Pauline has learned to love him too. Under the name of Maurier, Melnot wins great fame, and he returns to Lyons to find that Beausson has at last got Pauline in his power. With the players from my company, I shall play it for you. I shall play Melnot or Maurier, the hero, of course. As the scene opens, Beausson is addressing the lady Pauline.
Ah, Pauline, let me hope that you are reconciled to an event which confers such rapture upon me.
I am reconciled to my doom.
Doom is a harsh word, sweet lady.
This man must have some heart. It cannot be marble. Oh, sir, be just, be generous. Seize a noble triumph, a great revenge. Save the father and spare the child.
Joy, joy alike my hatred and my passion. The haughty Pauline is at last my suppliant. You ask from me what I have not the sublime virtue to grant, Pauline, a virtue reserved only for the gardener's son. I cannot forego my hopes in the moment of their fulfillment. I adhere to the contract. Your father's ruin, or your hand.
Then all is over. Ah, oh, here comes Cousin Damas and a stranger. Oh, perhaps Cousin Damas can help.
Ah, your servant, Cousin Deschapelles. Let me introduce Colonel Maurier.
The celebrated military hero of France?
My little cousin Pauline, I congratulate you. What, no smile, no blush? You are going to be divorced from poor Melnot and marry this rich gentleman. You ought to be excessively happy.
Happy?
Why? How pale you are, child. Poor Pauline.
Shh. Confide in me. Do they force you to this?
No.
You act with your own free consent?
My own consent, yes.
Then you are the most. I will not say what you are.
You think ill of me. Be it so. Yet if you knew all...
There is some mystery. Speak out, Pauline.
Oh, perhaps you can save me. You are our relation, our friend. My father's on the verge of bankruptcy. This day he requires a large sum to meet demands that cannot be denied. That sum, Bozin, will advance. My hand, the condition of the barter. Save me if you have the means. Save me.
I recant. Women are not so bad after all.
Child, I cannot help you. I am too poor.
Oh, the last plank to which I clung is shivered.
Hold. You see my friend, Morier? Melnot is his most intimate friend, fought in the same field, slept in the same tent. Have you any message to send to Melnot? Any word to soften the blow of your divorce from him?
He knows Melnot. He will see him. He will bear to him my last farewell. Sir, one word, I beseech you.
Her voice again, how the memory comes o'er me.
Sir, is it true that you have known, nay, are the friend of Melnot?
Lady, yes. Myself and misery know the man.
And you will see him, and you will bear to him, word for word, all that this heart which breaks in parting from him would send ere still forever.
Lady, speak on.
Tell him, for years I never nursed a thought that was not his, that on his wandering way, daily and nightly, poured a mourner's prayers. Tell him, e'en now, that I would rather share his lowliest lot, walk by his side an outcast, work for him, beg with him, live upon the light of one kind, smile from him, than wear the crown the Bourbon lost.
Am I already mad? You love him thus, and yet desert him?
Say that if his eye could read this heart, its struggles, its temptations, his love itself would pardon that desertion. Look on that poor old man. He is my father. He calls his child to save him. Shall I shrink from him who gave me birth? Tell him this and say that we shall meet again in heaven.
Damas, what is this riddle? What the nature of this sacrifice for this man Boussin?
The papers are prepared. We need only your hand and seal, Pauline. Quickly now.
Stay, lady. One word more. Where but your duty and your faith united, would you still share the low-born peasant's lot?
Would I? Ah, better death with him I love than all the pomp, which is but as the flowers that crown the victim. I am ready to sign.
Monsieur Deschapelles, these notes are yours the instant Pauline has signed. You will still be the great house of Lyons.
Never! And give me those notes. There, I tear them up.
Oh. Are you mad?
How, sir? What means this insult in my house?
Peace, Monsieur Deschapelles. I have a prior claim. Before the face of men and heaven, I urge it. I outbid yon sordid huckster for your priceless jewel. Take this purse. There is the sum twice told. Blush not to take it. There is not a coin that is not bought and hallowed in the cause of nations with a soldier's blood.
That voice, thou art...
Thy husband, look up.
Oh!
Look up, Pauline, for I can bear thine eyes. The stain is blotted from my name. I have redeemed mine honor. I can call on France to sanction thy divine forgiveness.
Fooled, duped, triumphed over in the hour of mine own victory. Curses on ye both. May thorns be planted in the marriage bed, and love grow soured and blackened into hate, such as the hate that gnaws me.
Aha, curse away, and let me tell thee, Beausang, a wise proverb the Arabs have. Curses are like young chickens. And still come home to roost.
Oh, my father, you are saved, and by my husband, our blessed hour.
I'm all astonished. Who then is Colonel Morier?
Morier no more after this happy day. I would not bear again my father's name till I could deem it spotless. The hour is come. Ah, the same love that tempteth into sin, if it be true love, works out its redemption, and he who seeks repentance for the past should woo the angel of virtue in the future.
Should woo the angel virtue. A noble sentiment, Sir Henry, a sentiment which guided me throughout all my life on earth.
I must have had a bit of a stuffy life, what?
Sir?
Oh, your pardon, madam, your pardon. But a great play. and I'm sure Queen Victoria herself must have applauded its sentiment. There are others which I fear me would not have fared so well in her favour.
The Queen, sir, as all the world remembers, set only the highest standards. But what plays are you referring? Oh, not that I'm interested, I assure you, but...
I am sure Her Majesty would not have approved the character of Dazzle in Boucicault's London Assurance.
Mm-hmm. But the Queen saw that play.
She did?
Oh, that is, I think she did. I think that may have been one of the few plays she saw after she gave up what you called her gay and flippant life.
And she approved the character of Dazzle, the charming bounder?
Oh, no, as to that, well, it was all so many years ago, once memory...
Oh, yes, of course, it was in the year 1841. But to tell me, spirit of woman, did you know the Queen during your time as a mortal?
Why, not as others knew her, no. But, This Dazzle you were talking about.
Ah, yes, yes, one of the most charming rogues unhung. You see, in the play, old Sir Harcourt Courtly is about to marry beautiful young Grace Harkaway, young enough to be his daughter. Under her father's will, she must either marry Sir Harcourt or his heir, or she loses her fortune. Max Harkaway, Grace's uncle, is calling on Sir Harcourt to arrange the marriage. Neither of them knows that Sir Harcourt's son, Charles, returned home late the night before, after a night of tippling, bringing with him Mr. Dazzle, whom he had met in a pub. We ought to meet Mr. Dazzle. I shall play Dazzle, of course. Max Harkaway speaks.
Ah, this young man, this must be young Charles. Ah, oh, Charles, is that you, my boy?
He knows me. He's too respectable for a bailiff. How are you?
Your father has just left me.
The devil he has. He's been dead these 10 years. Oh, I see. He thinks I'm young Courtly. The honor you would confer upon me, I most unwillingly disclaim. I am not Mr. Courtly.
I beg pardon. A friend, I suppose.
Oh, a most intimate friend. A friend of years, distantly related to the family. One of my ancestors married one of his. Adam and Eve.
Are you on a visit here?
Oh, yes, yes. Rather a short one, I'm afraid.
This appears a dashing sort of fellow. He's a friend of Sir Harcourt's. I'll invite him to the wedding. Sir, if you're not otherwise engaged, I shall feel honoured by your company at my house, Oak Hall, Gloucestershire.
Your name is?
Harkaway. Max Harkaway.
Harkaway. Let me see. I ought to be related to the Harkaway somehow.
A wedding is about to come off. Will you take a part in the occasion?
Oh, with pleasure. Any part but that of the husband.
Have you any previous engagement?
I was thinking, I promised to meet my tailor and his account tomorrow. However, I'll postpone that. Have you good shooting?
Shooting? Why, there's no shooting at this time of the year.
Oh, I'm in no hurry. I can wait till the season comes, of course. I was only speaking precautionally. You have good shooting?
Why, the best in the country.
Make yourself comfortable. Say no more. I'm your man.
You ride?
Anything, everything, from a blood to a broomstick. Only catch me a flash of lightning and let me get on the back of it. Hang me if I wouldn't astonish the elements. I'd put a girl around the earth in very considerably less than 40 minutes.
We'll show old Courtly how to spend the day. He imagines that nature, at the earnest request of fashion, made summer days long for him to saunter in the park, and winter nights that he might have good time to get cleared out at hazard or at whist. Give me the yelping of a pack of hounds before the shuffling of a pack of cards.
No cards or hounds for mine. My great adoration is for a goddess.
Ah, who's that?
When the world puts on its nightcap and extinguishes the sun, then comes the bottle. Wine and love are the only two indescribable things in nature, but I prefer the wine because its consequences are not entailed and are more easily got rid of.
How so?
Love ends in matrimony. Wine in soda water.
Well, I can promise you as fine a bottle as ever was cracked.
Never mind the bottle. Give me the wine. Say no more. But when I arrive, just shake one of my hands and put the key of the cellar into the other. And if I don't make myself intimately acquainted with its internal organization, I say nothing. Time will show.
Oh, I foresee some happy days.
And I some glorious nights.
But it mustn't be a flying visit.
I despise the word. I'll stop a month with you.
Or a year or two.
I'll live and die with you.
Remember, Max Harkaway, Oak Hall, Gloucestershire.
I'll remember. Fare ye well. I say, halloo, tally-ho! Here I am, quartered for a couple of years at the least. The old boy wants somebody to ride his horses, shoot his game, and keep a restraint on the morals of the parish. I'm eligible. What a lucky accident to meet young Courtly last night. Who could have thought it? Yesterday I could not make certain of a dinner except at my own proper peril. Today, I could flirt with a banquet.
Mm-hmm. There you are, madam, the most popular comedy of the 19th century.
Methinks you played your part just a bit too well, Sir Henry. You seem to relish the character.
Living or a spirit as I am now, madam, Henry Irving is an actor.
Sir Henry Irving, I believe it is.
It is, madam, and I am not sure that I like your tone at all. I met you here on the stage of Drury Lane, a spirit like myself, and I at least expected civility and a little...
Oh, I do apologize, Sir Henry. Sometimes I grow a little peremptory. I forget that I'm a spirit. But tell me, did the poor girl have to marry Sir Harcourt?
Yes, of course not. No, she married his young son, Charles. As for my relishing the character of Dazzle, madam, I have played many worse characters.
Indeed?
Yes, indeed. For instance, there is the character of the father in T.W. Robertson's play Cast. The play, by the way, was the beginning of realism during the Victorian era. The playwright was learning that he could make plays about the middle classes.
And the father in the play, what was he like?
But to put it boldly, madam, he was a scrounging toper, a man who lived off his daughter's earnings, in short, a no-good drunk.
Oh, how horrible.
Oh, horrible, yes, but such things exist, madam, now as they did while you and I were mortals on the earth.
I'm aware of it. The poor are always with us. They have always had my sympathy.
The poor are always... Queen Victoria herself may have spoken those words.
Perhaps I read them somewhere, but the play...
Yes. Well, Esther Eccles, a dancer, marries a man far above her station, the Honourable George Delroy. Delroy has kept his marriage a secret from his haughty mother, but the news leaks out just as he is ordered away to India with his regiment. While he is gone, his son is born to Esther. Shortly after the birth of her son, Esther hears shocking news. Her husband has been killed. What little money she has is spent on drink by her worthless father, who then writes Delroy's mother, telling her about the baby in the hope that the old lady will give Esther more money. At this moment, the Marquis Delroy is calling on Esther and has just offered to take the child away if Esther will agree never to see him again. Naturally, I will play the star part, the part of Eccles, the drunken father. But Esther Eccles is now heatedly addressing the Marquis Delroy.
Master George Delroy will remain with his mother. The offer to take him from her is an insult to his dead father and to him.
I don't seem to feel it, the stick-up little beast.
But you have no money. How can you rear him? How can you educate him? How can you live?
Turn Columbine. Go on the stage again and dance.
You are insolent. You forget that I am a lady.
You forget that I am a mother. Do you dare to offer to buy my child? His breathing image, his living memory with money. There is the dog. Go.
I'm very sorry, my lady, you should be threatened this way. This was not my wishes.
Silence, sir. Mrs. Delroy, if anything could have increased my sorrow for the wretched marriage my poor son was decoyed into, it would be your conduct this day to his mother.
To go away and not leave a shoe behind. A cat. Cat, stingy cat.
I'll go to my room, Father. I'll lie down. Let me have the baby, or that old woman may come back and steal him.
Well, women, you see, obstinate as devils that never wore horseshoes. Children, beasts. Here comes Sam and my Polly.
I'll tell him now, Polly, and get it over at once. And now, Mr. Eccles, I'd like to have a word with you, so I take this opportunity
take
to...
Take what you like and then order more, Samuel Gerridge. This end of the hand has never turned its back on a friend or a bottle to give him. I'll stand by my friend if he'll stand to me, gentlemen.
Mr. Eccles, sir, it's this.
Don't
sir.
Tell him too sudden, Sam. It might shock his feelings.
It's this, sir. You know that for the past 4 years I've been keeping company with Polly?
Go it. Strike home, young man. Strike on this grey head. Britain, strike home. Here to me heart. Don't spare me. Have a go at me grays. Pull them out. Long pull, strong pull. And they pull all together.
Oh, Father, I wouldn't hurt your feelings for the world.
Well, Mr. Eccles, I wouldn't wish to annoy you, sir, but... Now I'm going to enter on my own business. Here's a circular about it.
What circulars compared to her father's feelings?
And I wish Polly to name the day, sir. And so I ask you.
This is hard. This is hard. This is hard. One of me girls marries a soldier and the other goes a gas fitting.
The business, sir, which will enable me to maintain a wife is that of the late Mr. Binks, plumber, glazier.
They have given me to a plumber. They have broke every vow. They've given me to a plumber. And my heart is broken now. Now, gentlemen, now.
You know, Father, you can come and see me.
So I can, and that's a comfort. And you can see me. That's a comfort. I come and see you often, every day, and crack a fatherly bottle and shed a friendly tear.
Do, Father, do.
Yes, Mr. Eccles, do. If you want to. Well, why,
I will. And this it is to be a father. I'd part with any of my children for their own good readily, if I was paid for it. For I know that the angels is whispering to me, gentlemen.
I'll make Polly a good husband, sir. And anything I can do to prove it in the way of spirituous liquors and tobacco shall be done. Here's a crown for you.
Be kind to thy father wherever you be. For he is a blessing and a credit to thee, gentlemen. Well, my children, bless you. Take the blessing of a grey-haired father. Samuel Gerrish, he shall be thine. You shall be her husband. Look, a friend is waiting for me outside, which I wants to have a word with. And may you never know how much more sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a marriageable daughter.
But Sir Henry, what happened to the poor girl with the baby whose husband was killed? What happened to Esther?
What happened to her? Well, in the first place, the report of her husband's death in India was somewhat exaggerated. He turned up safe and sound in time for a tearfully happy ending in the third act.
Splendid. With such a father, surely she deserved happiness.
Surely, oh surely, madam. But when you were a mortal, did you often see such happiness? Except, of course, upon a stage.
But too often not. Despite the fact that I had a very large family, and thus an unusual opportunity to observe happiness. But, Sir Henry, life's troubles always carried their compensations, I found.
True, true, yes. Such as, for instance, when I played the bells.
The bells? Surely I did not see that.
Perhaps not. Oh, it was not a great play. In fact, rather a bad play. But the fact was, it was a great personal triumph for Henry Irving, myself.
But, if it was a bad play, what could it have had to commend it?
I might say fine acting, madam, but I won't. Actually, it was of the first, well, one of the first uses on the stage of psychic phenomena. Later, pipsqueak writers and halfpenny geniuses somewhat refined and discovered them as something new of their own. The fact is, almost the entire third act of the play takes place in a dream. Then there is a dream within a dream.
I'm afraid that sounds too complicated for me.
not at all, madam. The play was very simple. Matthias, a Polish innkeeper, desperately needed money. He had to pay bills, and his daughter was very ill. At his inn one bitter night, there stopped a rich man named Kowalski, and Kowalski had a belt of gold around his waist. Matthias murdered Kowalski and got the gold. With the money, he paid all his bills, and he rose in the world. He became burgomaster of his village, but always in his mind there was the memory of his foul deed. Often he could hear the sound of bells as he heard the sleigh bells that night on Kowalski's horse. Taking to his bed one night with a slight illness, Matthias dreamed that he was being tried for his crime, the crime of murder. I created the part of Matthias. In the dream, I am a prisoner and I am being questioned by the president of the court.
Prisoner Matthias, do you persist in your denial?
Yes,
There is nothing proved against me. It is a gross injustice to keep an honest man in prison.
You persist. Very well. We decree that you shall be examined by the mesmerist. Officer, summon the mesmerist.
I oppose it. I hear those bells only in my dreams. Dreams mean nothing.
Summon the mesmerist.
Your honors, I am the mesmerist.
Who can believe in the follies of the mesmerist? They merely perform the tricks of conjurers.
Mesmerist, you can send this man Matthias to sleep?
I can.
I will not be made the subject of this fakir's experiments.
I command it.
Sleep, Matthias. Sleep. Sleep.
No. No.
Methinks your resistance betrays you.
I have no fear.
Sleep, Matthias.
Courage. Courage. If I sleep, I am lost.
Calmly sleep. Sleep.
No. No, I will not sleep. I will not. No.
Now, mesmerist, ask him what he did on the night of the 24th of December, 15 years ago.
Matthias, I command you. You are at the night of the 24th of December, 1818. I command you. Speak.
It is 11:30. The people are leaving my inn. Finally, I am alone with Kovetsky, who warms himself at the stove. Outside, everything sleeps. Nothing is heard, except from time to time Kovetsky's horse under the shed when he shakes his bells.
Of what are you thinking?
I am thinking that I must have money, that if I have not 3,000 francs by the 31st, the inn will be taken from me. My little Annette will die of illness. I am thinking that no one is stirring this late at night, and that Kovetsky will follow the high road alone.
You have decided what to do, Matthias?
Yes. Yes. I will do it. I will risk it.
Go on.
Kovetsky asks how far it is to Mutzig. 4 leagues. I wish him well on his journey. He answers, God bless you. He goes out. He's gone. The axe. Where's the axe? Here, behind the door. Courage, Matthias. You shall have that precious money belt.
You follow him?
Yes, yes. I have crossed the fields. Here is the old bridge. And there below, the frozen rivulet. Oh, the dogs howl at Daniel's farm. How they howl. Kill the man. Kill the man. You will not do that, Matthias. But you will be rich. Your wife and child will no longer hunger. What dreadful silence. Perhaps Kovetsky has already passed. Thank heaven. Oh, what is that? Wait, the bells, the bells. He comes. He will be rich, rich. He will be rich, rich, Matthias, rich. He comes. Ah, Kovetsky, I have you now. I have you now. Come here, give me the axe. Ah. He does not move. The horse has fled with the sledge. Quick, quick. The purse. I have it. It's full of gold, gold, full of gold, quite full of gold. Quick, Matthias, quick. Carry him away to the lime kiln. Fires of the lime kiln, no one will ever know.
Matthias.
It is well, mesmerist. It is all written down. You may awake him.
Matthias. Matthias. Awake. I command you.
Where am I? Oh, yes. What is going on here? What is going on?
Clark, hand the prisoner his deposition. Let him read it.
Wretched fool, I've told all. I'm lost. It's false. I tear up these lies.
They are your own words, Matthias.
False lies. I tell you lies.
Considering that on the night of the 24th of December, between midnight and 1 o'clock, Matthias committed the crime of assassination on one Kavesky, the court condemns the said Matthias to be hanged by the neck until he is dead.
Nope. They're putting it around my neck. No. No.
Matthias, get up. 'Tis morning, Matthias. 'Tis late and all our guests are below for the wedding.
Aye, Burgomaster. All is waiting for Annette's wedding.
Matthias. Matthias. 'Tis me, Catherine, your wife.
Why, he doesn't answer. He was ill last night. You suppose...
Open the door, Christian. Open it, I say. Matthias! Oh!
Why, he's sitting up in bed, clutching his neck as if...
Matthias! Here's Olivia. Oh,
take the rope from...
My husband, Matthias, is dead!
Horrible, Sir Henry. Horrible.
Horrible, perhaps, but that play made me a star. That book and a manager who had faith in me, he was an American, by the way.
What? England's greatest actor brought forth by an American? Can that be?
Well, you may marvel, but truth it is. H.L. Bateman, his name was. Hezekiah Linthicum Bateman. Doesn't that name sound American?
Yeah, but why an American?
Oh, I picked the play, of course. He was an American manager in London, and he chose me to star for him. Really a dolt of a fellow. But with my guidance,
sir, perhaps we do well not to chide Americans. You and I are no longer mortals. But the England in which we lived is mortal still. In these days, England looks across Atlantic for a friend.
Yes, spirit of woman, you are right. I should not have spoken so.
Perhaps Englishmen have always been too ready with ridicule for the unfamiliar.
No, there I do not agree with you, for Englishmen have always had the ability first to criticize themselves and their institutions, to make fun of their failings.
I'm afraid I don't quite follow.
I am an actor, so I look for examples in all things to the theater. As one who could criticize, there is the playwright W.S. Gilbert.
Gilbert? Do you mean that Gilbert who worked with Sir Arthur Sullivan? Oh, Sir Arthur, a noble gentleman.
Yes, but I would say perhaps that it was Sir Arthur who worked with Gilbert. Perhaps if Gilbert had not had such ready criticism for England, he too would have been knighted much sooner. Then there is Kipling. Perhaps but for one line he wrote, Kipling might also have accepted knighthood. Ah, the good Queen Victoria knew how to punish as well as reward.
You think so?
I think so. Only I and the whole empire back in the days when all of us were mortal. Didn't you think so?
Oh, perhaps. But what is there about this fellow Gilbert that you so admire?
His work. His ability to criticize. For example, in his play Pygmalion and Galatea, he laughs at England's smug morality, at the complacency of any civilization. Do you know the play?
Only the legend, I'm afraid.
Well, here is a scene in the play. Pygmalion's statue of Galatea has just come to life. Galatea is learning about herself and about other mortals. Of course, I shall play Pygmalion, but Galatea speaks.
Then I am beautiful.
Indeed thou art.
I wish that I could look upon myself, but that's impossible.
Not so, indeed. This mirror will reflect thy face. Here it is. Look. Behold.
How beautiful I am. Oh, believe me, love, I could look in this mirror all day long. So, I'm a woman.
There is no doubt of that.
Oh, happy maid to be so passing fair.
Hush, Galatea. In thine innocence thou sayest things that others would reprove.
Indeed, Pygmalion, then it is wrong to think that one is exquisitely fair.
Well, Galatea, it's a sentiment that every other woman shares with thee. They think it, but they keep it to themselves.
And is thy wife as beautiful as I?
No, Galatea, for in forming thee I took her features, lovely in themselves, and in the marble made them lovelier still.
Oh, then I'm not original.
Well, no, not exactly, no.
Well, I'm very glad that I'm lovelier than she. And am I better?
That I do not know.
Then she has faults?
Very few indeed. I love her all the better for her faults.
Well, tell me some of her faults. I'll commit them.
Faults will come to you quickly enough. Though for that matter, it's a grievous matter to sit together as we are doing now.
Is sin so pleasant? If to sit and talk as we are sitting be indeed a sin, why, I could sin all day. Pygmalion, I like thy wife.
And why?
Why, our tastes agree. We love Pygmalion well. And what is more, Pygmalion loves us both. I like thy wife. I'm sure that we'll agree.
I doubt it very much.
How pleased she'll be to know when she returns that there was someone here to fill her place.
Yes, I'd say she'd be extremely pleased.
Oh, Pygmalion, is it possible? Your voice says one thing when you seem to mean another.
A few moments ago, Galatea, you were stone. You have a lot to learn. My wife will not be pleased. There, that's the truth.
Well, I do not think that I shall like thy wife after all. But tell me more. When last she left thee, what did she say?
Well, let me see. She feared I should be lonely till she came. She counseled me if thoughts of love should come to speak those thoughts to thee, as I am wont to speak to her.
Yes, yes.
But when she spoke, Galatea, thou wast a stone. Now thou art flesh and blood. Even thou can see that the difference is worth a passing mention.
It's a strange world. A woman fears her husband will be lonely till she comes, and will not let me cheer his loneliness. She bids him breathe his love to senseless stone, and when that stone is brought to life, be dumb. It's a strange world.
Let me be brave and put an end to this. Come, Galatea, till my wife returns, my sister shall provide thee with a home. Her house is close at hand.
Oh, send me not hence, Pygmalion. Let me stay.
It may not be, Galatea.
But when my wife returns, she'll let me stay with thee.
I do not know. Why should I hide the truth from her? Alas, I may not see thee then.
Pygmalion, what fearful words are these?
The bitter truth. I may not love thee. I must send thee hence.
Oh, recall those words, Pygmalion, my love. See, I am thy work. Thou hast created me. The gods have sent me to thee. I am thine, thine only, and unalterably thine. This is the thought with which my soul is charged. Thou tellest me of one who claims thy love, that thou hast love for her alone. Alas, I do not know these things. I only know that heaven has sent me here to be with thee. Thou tellest me of duty to thy wife, of vows that thou wilt love but her. Alas, I do not know these things. I only know that heaven who sent me here has given me one all-absorbing duty to discharge, to love thee and to make thee love again.
No. No, no. Oh, Galatea. Oh.
Brazen hussy. I am indeed glad you did not show me more, Sir Henry.
I am afraid one of Gilbert's faults was his inability to write romantically about women. He wrote with realism, the result being that he never created a serious female character that any other woman could abide.
That is sheer frippery, trash. As a mortal, Sir Henry Irving, you represented the English theatre during the time of Victoria. Is this all the theatre had to offer?
Ah, I see. You want something with more of a moral, eh?
Well, some... something more nearly approaching the ideal of an honest, God-fearing people. Sir, that was England in the time when I was a mortal.
Let me see. Yes, yes, perhaps I have it. Then again, perhaps not.
Well?
Michael and His Lost Angel by Henry Arthur Jones. In that play, the hero was a man of God. I'll play the hero.
And would I approve its sentiments?
You may judge that for yourself, madam. Briefly, the play concerns Michael, a minister, and his fight against temptation. Michael's library worker is a widower named Andrew, and Andrew's daughter, Rose, has been discovered to be a maid of errant ways.
Must we hear all about her?
I'm afraid so. She's necessary to the plot, as it were. Well, Michael decrees that Rose can only be saved by a public confession, which will mean humiliation for Rose.
Honest confession is good for the soul.
Yes, yes, that's what Michael said. At the time, he was sincere about it, too. Well, into Michael's parish, there moved a rich and beautiful widow, Audrey Lesden, and she formed a fatal attraction for Michael. By chance, Michael and Audrey were forced to spend a night on an island, a fact which Andrew discovered. They decided that they loved each other and would be married. Then Audrey learned that her husband was alive and that she was still married to him. She has just told Michael of this, and he is stunned.
Speak to me. Say that you aren't sorry. Say that deep down in your inmost heart you aren't sorry for what has passed.
Sorry? No. Heaven forgive me. I'm not sorry. I can't be. I wish I could.
Oh, now I know you love me. If only you dared be as bold as I dare. To dare everything.
Dare?
We love each other. Our loves and lives are in our own hands.
Can't you see, Audrey, that we are halfway down the precipice? We'll go no further. From this moment, we part. I toil back to repentance and peace one way. You toil back another. I'll never think of you from this moment. You do the same. Heaven giving us grace, ask only one thing for yourself and me, that we may forget each other.
I was right about man's love, Michael. You were all cowards. There's not one of you that doesn't think first of his comfort, or his pocket, or his honor, or his skin, or his soul, and second of the woman he thinks he loves. Forget you. Do you think that possible? Do you think I was jesting with you when I gave you my love? I'm afraid my memory retains such trifles. Forget you.
I have no guide but you. Wherever you go, I shall follow, be sure of that. But why can't you be my better angel now that I've lost my good angel? If you love me as you say, you can yet be the master influence in my life. You can yet save yourself through me and me through you. Won't you make our love a monument for good? Dearest of all, I am at your feet. I think you come from heaven, and I'm all obedience to you. You are my angel. Lead me. Lead me not back to sin. Lead me toward heaven. You can, even now.
What do you wish me to do?
Go back to your duty and repentance. Have strength, dearest. These are not idle words. Duty, purity, holiness. Love is nothing without them. Have courage to tread the hard road. Now leave me.
If I leave you now, shall we meet one day hereafter?
Yes.
You're sure? You do believe it?
With all my heart.
And you'll stay here and carry on your work. Restore the church and let me think that I'm helping you.
I can't do that now.
Yes.
But with that money, your money...
Many churches are built with sinners' money. Do this for me.
If I dared, if it would come to good. You know how dear a hope it has been to me all my life through to restore the old church.
Do it because I ask it. You will.
And you'll leave me. Leave this place because I ask it. You will.
I love you. I obey. And listen to this, Michael. Whatever happens, I shall never belong to anybody but you. You understand?
I understand.
I shall never belong to anybody but you, Michael. Ah, but here comes Andrew up the pathway to the study. I'll go out this... back way. Goodbye, Michael.
You won't begin work this morning, I suppose.
What? Oh, work. Yes, Andrew. Yes, I will work. Here is the manuscript. Where is the place?
51st Psalm, verse 3. Have you found it? Why, what are you looking at?
I can't bear it, Andrew. I tell you, I can't bear it.
Can't bear what? Don't I tell you that all is safe? I shan't blab, I assure you. No one shall ever know.
But you know.
I shall never remind you of it.
But you do, you do. Your presence reminds me.
Shall I leave you now and come again by and by?
No, stay. You've sent for Rose to come home, as I asked.
No.
No?
I don't want to have her in this place where everybody knows about her, where she will see every day the people to whom she confessed from the pulpit.
Won't you send for her, Andrew, to please me?
She's well enough where she is. Shall we go on with the work?
No. Oh, what ought I to do now, Andrew?
Mete out to yourself the same measure you meted out to others. To my Rose.
Confess. In public. I can't, I can't, I daren't. I'm a coward, a weak, miserable coward. Don't judge me harshly, Andrew. Don't be hard on me.
Come, sir, shall we get on with our work? Here is the verse. I will read it to you. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me.
If I am a judge of English character, Michael confessed.
You are, madam, and he did. He confessed. He gave up his church, and at the end there was only the only moral comfort to be enjoyed in any impure love, the death of one of the lovers.
And the one who died, it was not Michael.
There speaks the true woman. It was not Michael, no. But society's so-called debt was paid.
So-called debt? Then you think the debt unjust?
Perhaps I think many debts of society unjust, but I am a mortal no longer. I can afford to think that way. Why, one of the greatest plays of my era was called The Second Mrs. Tanqueray by Arthur Wing Pinero. Its whole thesis was the effort to prove that a woman with a past must pay severely for that past, no matter what her course of life, after she recognized her errors.
And you do not agree with that? It was an accepted fact during my life as a mortal.
Oh, likewise mine. And as a mortal, I acted in agreement with many things about which I am now not so sure. I was egotistical. They say I murdered the King's English. Shaw even went so far as to disagree with my acting. But, madam, I conformed. I addressed colleges and universities on the high place of the drama. My companies always made money, and so I was knighted. Yes, I conformed. And now that I am no longer a mortal, I am glad that I conformed. I was buried in Westminster Abbey because I conformed. That is one of England's greatest honors, you know.
Yes, I know. You see, I conformed too. And I also might have been buried in Westminster Abbey.
What's that? You, a woman, buried in the Abbey?
Yes, Sir Henry.
But, madam, who are you? As a mortal, who were you?
I was... But perhaps you would understand better if I gave you an example, such as you have given me of the theatre of our time.
But you were not of the theatre, I would know you.
Of the theatre, no. But plays have been written about me, about my life. Perhaps the best-known scene... One of the best known, certainly, takes place in Kensington. The time is 5 o'clock in the morning of June the 20th, 1837. An 18-year-old girl has been wakened out of a sound sleep by a caller of great importance. That 18-year-old girl was myself.
Yes, my dear. The Archbishop and Lord Cunningham have gone.
Oh, Mama.
Now you must go back to sleep and rest.
Sleep? I couldn't think of it. I'm so excited.
I know, dear. That's why you must go back to sleep. Excitement is not good for you. And only rest will soothe you.
Really, Mama, I couldn't think of sleeping. Oh, Fräulein Lesen, must I go back to bed?
Your dear Mama says so. But perhaps I can persuade her.
If you please, your ladyship, she is so upset by this news. I am sure she could never go to sleep.
It would be good for her, and she may no longer think of herself alone.
Oh, but Mama, I never have, and so often I have wanted to, so badly.
You have been brought up for your own best interest, my dear.
But now, dear Mama, things are different. I hope you will grant me the first request that I make of you.
Why? What is it?
I want a room of my own, and I want to be by myself for an hour.
Your Majesty, Queen Victoria.
Arise, Sir Henry Irving, for now you and I are equals in an equal sphere.
But you are Victoria, the Queen.
And now no longer a mortal, but a spirit like yourself.
A spirit, ma'am, yes. But if the spirit world respects rank, I pay you my respect with all my heart.
Listen, Sir Henry, listen.
It's the air raid warning, the alert.
Yes, for England, the alert. You and I, Sir Henry, each in our time has been a part of England. We are not dead. Our spirits are alert. The spirit of Victoria, the Queen, of Sir Henry Irving, the actor, the spirit of Alfie, the porter, here at Drury Lane. Yes, and the spirit of countless millions who in their time have been a part of England. No, Sir Henry, we are not dead.
During the past hour, you have heard Curtain Calls for the Queen, a fantasy by Welburn Kelly on the drama in England during the reign of Queen Victoria. Included in our cast were Queen Victoria, Estelle Winwood, Sir Henry Irving, Alfred Shirley, the porters, Stanley Harrison and Philip Tong, and the players were Kay Strozzi, Jean Muir, Marjorie Maud, George Koulouris, Barry Jones, J.P. Wilson, and Elizabeth Reller. Next Sunday's drama presentation at this time will be the American play The Climbers, written by Clyde Fitch in 1905. A Great Plays Drama Guide by Blevins Davis, who arranged for the series, is available to our radio audience at the cost of 25 cents. Send coin or money orders to Great Plays, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. The Great Plays Drama Guide contains a summary of the plot, sketch of the author's life, and pertinent facts about each of the 30 plays in this series. Consult your local library for reading material on the remaining Great Plays of the series. This program has been presented as a public service by the National Broadcasting Company and the independent radio stations associated with the NBC networks. It came to you from the RCA building, Radio City, New York.